Hi, Larry Mueller here, and thanks for joining us on this Memorial Day. We're speaking to John Armbruster. He's the author of a new book. It's titled Tailspin, and it tells the story of Gene Moran, a man from Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin, whose plane was shot down during World War II and was captured by the Nazis, and he lived to tell his story. Only it took some years for him to recount it, and even then he chose just one person to tell. He told his story to our guest, John Armbruster. John is a family friend of the Morans who has worked as a journalist and history teacher, spent 3 years talking to Gene and researching his story, and he joins us now. And I want to let you know that we recorded this interview for you today, so you can hold your calls today and just listen in as I speak with John. John, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is a fantastic story, but maybe start at the beginning. Who was Gene Moran, and how'd you meet him?
You know, it's funny. I was just out in your lounge, and I was thumbing through a magazine of Charlie Barron's. And I'm like, you know, Charlie Barron's in a tail gun would make a good comparison to who Gene Moran is. He was that type of character, loved Wisconsin, and was a very humorous guy. Gene Moran was born in 1924, grew up in Ridge and Valley Country in the Driftless area of Wisconsin, and was a dairy farmer. A dairy farmer family. And I can't think of a tougher apprenticeship for the travails of World War II than being a dairy farmer in Ridge and Valley Country. Yeah. It was just constant work. Deprivation, he said, you know, we always had food, but we didn't have a dime to our name. And from the fire to the frying pan, depression of World War II.
Yeah, absolutely. And talk about how you came to know the Moran family, because I thought that was kind of interesting, too.
Yeah, I became a teacher at North Crawford Schools, a high school and middle school social studies teacher in 1994. And it was at a teacher's in service in October, and I kind of didn't know anybody. And I was kind of lounging around just sitting with myself, and I heard two teachers in front of me saying, well, this is the town where that guy fell 4 miles without a parachute and lived. And so I leaned forward and piqued my interest. And they start talking, and I'm like, oh, this, they can't have their facts straight. What, fell 4 miles, shot down 4 miles without a parachute? And they mention the name. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. That's my teaching colleague. She's right next to me. Joni Moran Peterson. And so I remember running into her room at the end of that afternoon. I'm like, is this your dad? Are you kidding me? Did this really happen, or did those guys have that story wrong? And she's like, oh, yeah, Lean Gene, the fighting machine. And I'm like, well, oh, my God. And, you know, I'm a rookie history teacher. I'm like, I've already had it planned in my head. We're going to do lessons, and we're going to do projects, and Gene's going to come in and talk. And and she just said, that's not happening.
Remember her words.
We don't go there. And then a few days later, she gave me a newspaper article. The La Crosse Tribune had done a short article on him. He gave a few sentences, and that was in 1992. And she's like, that's all we have. She said, maybe someday I can have you talk with him, but whatever you find out, you'll know more than we do.
And several years went by, did they not?
It did. I got to know the family. Joni and my late wife became very good friends, and we got to know the Morans. And Gene's wife died in 2003, and both my father and my late wife's father died early, so Gene kind of became a surrogate grandfather to my kids. My boys loved him, and we watched Packer games together, and we talked fishing and hunting, but I knew we never dared talk about the war. Yeah. I'd look at his hands, and I'm such a history buff, and I've always been a World War II buff. And I'd look at his hands, and I'd be like, my God, those hands fired on some of the Luftwaffe fighter pilots. Yeah. And I was just dying to know, but I didn't ask until 2010.
In 2010, I guess he decided he was ready to talk.
And yes, it started actually in 2007. Congressman Ron Kind held a veterans event. He had something called a Veterans Oral History Project, where he interviewed veterans, and he had a specific day for Gene Moran and another World War II flyer in that area, and they flew in a Flying Fortress from EAA over in Oshkosh, And Ron interviewed him for 20 minutes. And I remember Joni, his daughter, excitedly calling me. It's like, oh, my God, you got to get up here. Dad's finally going to talk. And so I went to the airport. And Ron had, to his credit, it was a tough interview. It was 20 minutes. Gene looked down a lot. He gave short, cryptic answers. And he kind of motioned that I want this to stop. And it was tough for Ron to do that. But that got it going. And so in the next ensuing 2-3 years, I and other people, Gene's veteran friends from his American Legion post, we were like, you've got to get an author to write a story. This is one of the most incredible World War II stories I've ever heard. He's in his mid-80s. He's going to take this to the grave. You've got to do something. And I was one of the loudest voices for that until they came back to me and said, well, why don't you do it? And you said, you have a journalism degree from here, UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. I worked downstairs in Vilas Hall for a few years. And I said, that was 20-some years ago, and I was writing high school basketball roundups. No way. And then they came back to me a couple weeks later and said, he's thinking about it, but he's not going to do it unless you do it.
So you did it.
So I did it.
Started Thursdays.
Thursdays with Gene, January 2011 is when we started that.
And went on for a few years. And, you know, in your book, one of the things I kind of liked about your book was, I mean, you talk some of the backstory and then what's going on. And then you go into Gene's experiences and then you bring us back to the present, maybe with something going on with his family. And I liked the story the way you told it. And sometimes it was kind of a relief in a way from the horrors that he went through. To be able to go back and...
Yeah, I give a lot of credit to my editor. I met Heather Schumacher here at UW-Madison at the Writers Institute.
I know Heather, yeah.
And we had to submit a chapter. I'd written one chapter of this book, and it was a pretty rough chapter. And she had 25 selections, but she decided to kind of take me on. And she asked, what are your plans with this book? I said, well, I was going to write it. The family was going to self-publish. And we were going to do something very local in southwestern Wisconsin. And she said, I think you have a bigger story here. I think you ought to go the traditional publishing route. And I call Heather a friend now. She was amazing. And she really held my feet to the fire, the rewrites that I had to do over and over. But it was her suggestion when she said, you know, I find him a fascinating man as an old man. Could we weave him in these interviews almost like a Tuesdays with Maury into the story? And I'm like, I like that. So it took a little doing. And she mentioned, too, that, you know, there have been a lot of World War II guys that have told their stories in the past 10 years. You know, I'm thinking, you know, Unbroken in 2010. We kind of aim to do something different. And then also she came up to me as we're putting this together. She said, wait a minute. I mentioned that my wife was dying during all this of cancer. And she said, wait, your wife was dying? And I said, yes, during these 3 years of these interviews. And she said, well, as a reader, I need to know that. And at first I was like, no, you don't. I lived it. I'm not writing about it. Gene and my late wife are very good friends. And so their deaths and their struggle intertwined. And long story short, I went with my editor's gut. And I think it's a very, I hear over and over, it's a very unique World War II story.
Yeah, it really is. And I've read many, many, many World War II stories because I'm kind of a history buff that way as well. Let's start Gene's story kind of at his 18th birthday, because that's when he...
Lied to
get into the... Because he was always interested in flying, and he wanted to get up in the air and fly.
He did. Yeah, I love the story where he was supposed to go out and bring in the cows for milking, and he was late. His dad was mad because he saw an airplane flying over the Kickapoo Valley, and he chased it.
He'd never seen one.
No, I don't know if that's the first time, but it was a very rare thing to see a plane in late 20s, early 30s in the Kickapoo Valley, and he was, with pride. He said, I got the pilot to wave back at me, and he said, someday I'm going to be up there. But when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, he was actually working at his uncle's farm, and when he came in and heard the news, he said he was actually elated, and that took me by surprise. I'm like, elated? He said, oh my God, he said, I couldn't wait to get off the farm. He was so sick of dairy farm life. He said, he was 17 at the time. He said, as soon as I turn 18, I'm going to Madison to the, it was right on the square, the Army Air Corps recruiting base. But when he got there, found out that you can't join the Air Corps without parent permission, because that was an all-volunteer service. So you had to be, you could join at 21, but before that, even at 18, you had to have parent permission. Well, so Gene had a cousin, and he forged the signatures. The recruiter didn't buy it. He got his cousin, who had better handwriting, to forge the signatures. He didn't buy it again and said, young man, you come back with any more of these forged signatures, you're not going into the service. You're going to jail. So he goes home and tells his mom that he lied again and said, I'm already in the service. And she says, well, no, you're not. We never signed for you. He said, yes, I forged your signatures. I'm in. And then she said, well, we can get that broke. And he said, no, I already took the oath. And there's nothing you can do about it, which was another lie. So he lied his way into the Army Air Corps, got his parents to sign only because they thought he was already in and thought he would get in trouble if they didn't sign. So his whole basis for being in the Army Air Corps was one big lie.
One big lie. Oh, man. Our guest today, John Armbruster, we're talking about his book. It's called Tailspin, and it's the story of Gene Moran and his time in the service. And I'm really glad to have him with us today to talk about Gene's story. And he goes to basic training,
yep.
and he volunteers. He wants to be a tail gunner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said he wanted to be a pilot. But as he said, you know, my report card ran pretty heavy to the C's and D's in high school. Wasn't sure if my grades were going to make muster. And this was in 42. They were looking for gunners. The air war was really heating up in Europe, and they were taking pretty heavy casualties, the 8th Air Force was. So he immediately jumped on that, and he went out to Las Vegas to gunnery school, where he did very, very well. Some of the recruits had trouble handling those heavy 50 caliber machine guns. And he just said all those years of milking cows by hand really had steeled his forearms. But then he had a ripped hernia at the time he had to qualify. And he and some other gunners, again, lied about some other fellow gunners painted their bullets the same colors as Gene's bullets so that get him to qualify. And because Gene was having trouble making his score because he had a ripped hernia.
In such pain.
Yeah, he was in such pain while firing. And the pilot was trying to help him out, get him close to the target. And the sergeant who did the scoring to qualify him looked at the panel that they had to hit and was so. And he said, I don't understand. He said, you had 500 bullets to qualify. I've got 700 orange holes here. How did that happen? And all the other gunners like, oh, I thought it was my turn to be orange. I thought it was my turn to be orange. And he said, screw it. You're qualified. And then went to have surgery on his hernia, so he just barely made it.
John Armbruster, our guest, the book Tailspin. I'm Larry Mueller on this Memorial Day. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking today with John Armbruster, his book Tailspin, the story of Gene Moran and his life. Just an incredible story during the war of his life. And we're going to learn some more about it right now as I talk with Gene. And, you know, so eventually they wind up, he gets, you know, they go through all the basic training, which mm-hmm. was we won't go into here, but it was quite a story in and of itself. But then they weren't sure if they were going to go to Japan or right. they were going to go to Germany. But they wind up on their way to Germany, and he with a group of guys that he trained with, and became friends with, almost like family members.
He said his classic quote: "We were closer than brothers." And I had the book launch on April 30th, and I had some audio quotes from Gene. And I think one that really moved the crowd, he said, you know, we were a tight, tight family, the 10 of us on that Flying Fortress crew. He said, I said, officers too? He's like, well, yeah. He said, we called each other by our first names. You know, we didn't salute. We just, everything was nicknames, and we teased one another. They were very, very close.
And those planes did not have, I mean, there were a lot of people lost their lives in those planes.
They were expendable. Last summer, I flew in a B-17 at the Oshkosh Air Show. And what I found remarkable. There's no creature comforts. There's no padding. There's sharp edges everywhere. And you take your finger and you feel that aluminum skin. And I'm like, you could shove a screwdriver through this. You know, there just wasn't much protection. And of course, they weren't heated. They're not pressurized, so they had oxygen masks, and many things could go wrong with them. The casualties were terrible, particularly with the 8th Air Force flying out of England.
Yeah, they were indeed. And he managed, and they were supposed to get, I think, 25 flights. And he went through, his first one was obviously... a little scared, I think, to start with, but managed to get through it. And then there were some aborted efforts where even though they may have even gotten out and flown almost to the site, they didn't get credit for it.
That's right. He, in November of 43, he arrived in England at the 96th Bomb Group in Snetterton Heath. And this is in East Anglia, the eastern part of Great Britain, which is pretty much a gigantic aircraft carrier. It's just... Army Air Force bases everywhere. And usually there was a training phase, some practicing, and he said they were pressed into service right away. This is soon after some of the worst raids that the 8th Air Force had to endure, particularly the Schweinfurt raids. They needed guys and planes now. He said we only had a few days before our first mission. He said that entire month of November, he was up 19 times, but he only got credit for 5 missions. And I remember the growl in his voice. And it angered him, and he said, you know, one mission they fought all the way into their target, but they couldn't find their target, and he said, you didn't get credit unless you dropped your bombs on that target or a secondary target. So you'd come all the way back, and you wouldn't get credit for that mission, but he got credit for 5 missions before he was shot down.
And what a riveting story, the day that he was shot down. Describe a little bit about that day.
Yes. I think it starts best 3 days earlier. They were supposed to go on November 26, 1943. They were supposed to go to Bremen, but their pilot got sick. So he got out of that one. And Bremen is a city, and it's an industrial city about the size of Milwaukee, one of the most heavily defended cities that Germany had. When the target was revealed in the morning, this was all top secret. You know, it's just a lump in their throat when they see that it's Bremen as the target. 3 days earlier, they didn't have to fly, but parts of the crew did to fill in as substitutes for other crew. They all made it back, but I remember Gene took beer to his crewmates as they're getting out of the plane, and his bombardier was a teetotaler. He was going to be a Christian minister, and I'll never forget the scene. Gene said, well, I found Curtis. I knew he didn't drink, so I didn't give him the beer. Curtis grabbed the jug and just started chugging. And he looked at, and Gene looked at him in wonderment, like, you don't drink. And Curtis just looked at him and said, Bremen. And 3 days later, they had to go back. And Gene said, and I've looked at the documents from National Archives and from the Air Force Historical Regency. There's quite a bit of documentation on it. The Germans threw everything but the kitchen sink at those guys that day. Every type of plane you could think of. And Gene said, it seemed like we were constantly shooting. We fought our way all the way in. The flak, he said, you could have got out and walked on it. It was horrific. And their plane had taken some damage, but nothing severe. And they dropped their bomb load, and he thought, thank God, we made it. And they banked, headed west, and everything was going pretty well. And then they got hit by an onslaught of German fighters on their way home. And for reasons that Gene will never know, his flying fortress fell back to the other flying fortresses. And he said he even called up, what's going on? Why are we falling back? And someone said, I don't know. And, of course, that's every airman's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
And they were...
away from your protection.
Away from the protection of the other squadron. There was nothing anyone else could do for them. And I asked Gene, so how many fighters hit you? He said, I have no idea. It might have been a dozen, might have been 20. He said, every one of us was firing. And he said the noise was deafening. And he said, we couldn't hear the pilot. They thought their co-pilot got hit right away and killed. Don't know if the pilot was wounded, but nobody could hear him. Don't know if his electronic communications were shot up. But then one by one, he could hear everybody dying and screaming on the intercom. His best friend was a ball turret gunner. He heard him die. There was a plane coming up from underneath. And he told him, he said, "Mo, I'm a goner." And then he could hear shells crashing into his ball turret. And that very plane flew up past Gene, and Gene hit it really, really hard. And then I think I remember Gene telling me this when I interviewed him in his mobile home. And then a German ME-109, a Messerschmitt fighter, pulled up right next to Gene. And Gene's telling me this, and I'm writing things down. I'm like, "What? You had a German fighter pull up right next to you?" He goes, "Well, outside of the range of my guns." He knew where my guns were. I'm like, "How far away was he from me to the TV?" I'm like, "Are you kidding?" He said, "Oh, I could see his scarf. I could see his goggles." What did he do? Well, he pointed down. He kept pointing down. And he said, "At first I didn't understand it, but then I figured out he was telling me to bail out." But then he said someone cut loose from the front. He didn't know if it was the waist gunner or the top turret gunner. And then he peeled out of there. And that was his chance for reprieve. That was his chance to get out. Well, once he got shot at, I think there were other fighters waiting, and they came in and finished off the plane.
And the tail section came, that part of it, reading that part was horrific. They're 4 miles in the air.
There, yeah. Gene figured they dropped several thousand feet in the air battle with the German fighters. And then after he, that one German pilot gave him a chance to get out, and then he got shot at, that pilot took off, and then a bunch of fighters moved in for the kill. Then Gene got shot. He was shot through both forearms. A 20-millimeter cannon explosion shoved him into his guns, and he broke all his ribs on his left side. And then a bullet passed through his parachute, and he just said silk went flying everywhere. And he could feel then that the plane was going down and shuddering, and he knew it's over. But he had a spare parachute by the tail wheel just in front of him. Now, so you got to admit, he's crawling forward with G-forces, just pinning him to the floor. And it was just an incredible...
He's dropping like a rock.
He's dropping like a rock. He looked forward, saw both waist gunners, Sweeto and Andy, lying on the floor. They're dead. And you could see them. But he's just inches from the parachute. And he's crawling. And he said he's kind of crawling on his elbows because his forearms are busted by an enemy bullet. And so his elbows are like trying to drag him forward. And he's almost at the spare parachute, and the plane just ripped in front of him. And he shoved his forearms into the fuselage to prevent from falling out. He said that there was sky in front of his whole face. And he said he just barely managed falling out. But he said, "I could see the tailless plane float out in front of me. I could see it go." And it drops like a rock, and he whipped his body around and pulled out a rosary that his grandmother had given him. And he said, I rubbed those beads so hard, I rubbed flesh right off my fingers just praying. But at the same time, he said, "You know, I relaxed. Why fight it? I'm going to die." He said, I was conscious all the way down. He said, "I just relaxed. I'm going to die. Why fight it?"
And he hits the ground. He hits through a little...
Hits a forest. And he hits some trees, and the speed, the rate of fall was quite quick. I think some people think that, well, since it was a tail section, did he flutter? Did he float? He fell so fast that his teeth fillings popped out. His dental fillings popped out. The G-forces pushed blood into his eyes. He couldn't see. He was blinded for several days. And he fell into a woods. And I've been to this woods. On the 75th anniversary, the people of the area commemorated the day and invited myself and the family over. And I've been to the actual woods. And I'm expecting, you know, the Alps. I'm expecting a sloping hillside, large, bushy pine trees, something that could explain that saved him. And it wasn't. It looked like a woods from where I grew up in Marshfield, Wisconsin. Very marshy, very flat. There was just nothing there. And I'm looking around and talking to some people that knew the story. I'm like, "This is it? This is..." I'm like, and then there was a German television crew that was recording our story. And they asked me, they said, "Well, you interviewed him. You're writing the book. Can you explain how he survived?" I'm like, "No, I can't. I have no idea."
He had no idea.
He had no idea.
He said he thought he was dead, and then realized
he did.
I'm alive.
He hit the ground. He said there was kind of some twisting and turning, so he didn't know what happened. But it just so happened the open part of the tail kind of landed on the ground where he was able to crawl out, and he crawled toward the light. And that's the typical, "I'm dead," crawl toward the light. But then he got outside. Now he's blinded at this point. His eyes are all red. But he could smell the cold November air. He kind of turned around and laid on his back. But then he started grabbing some leaves and twigs, and he's like,
I'm alive.
And he starts laughing. He starts giggling. He's like, oh, my God, I cheated death. Felt no pain at that point, but then he said he had a strange sensation coming from his head. And he moved his hand up there, and he could feel the goo, to be quite honest. And he had cracked his skull, and his brain was exposed at that point. And he said, I knew at that moment I wasn't going anywhere. And so he laid there.
And somebody came and got him, and the Germans got him.
But it was actually the Frenchman that found him first.
Right.
Yes. He's lying there, and he hears these voices, and Jean doesn't speak French or German, but, you know, he knows some basics, and the language didn't sound German. And he recognized, I think it's French. And there was a nearby POW camp, and the Germans would let the French POWs go out scrounging for food. But during air raids, they would actually scavenge wrecked airplanes. They knew the American flyers had Hershey bars on them, and so there was food. And Gene said, so they came up to him. Now they thought he was dead. And so they're rifling through his chest and his coat. So the one thing they did is they ripped the microphone off him right away, because they used that for their underground radios. They used the parts to make their own radios. And then Gene looked up at him, and he could kind of make out hazy figures of bodies. He says about four or five of them. And he said, doctor, doctor. And he said, they just, like a ghost had just risen. They were like, oh, my God. And they were chattering. And then he said, they're pointing at the tail and they're yelling. And then they left. And then they came back with German soldiers. And they dragged him. He was only about 20 meters from the edge of the woods. And then they threw him onto an ox cart. And then paraded him took him into town, where he's almost lynched. He could hear voices coming. They're shouting, Schwein, Schwein, for pig, gangster, gangster. And he could hear rocks hitting the cart. And then he felt spit on his face, and he knew they were coming to get him and attack him. And they had known this. They knew that sometimes they had been told, you want the German military to find you, not the local people. The local people will kill you. Because so many of their bombs, of course, were errant and were killing many civilians. Ironically, it was the German soldiers that saved him. They yelled and shouted and threatened for everyone to get away. Had they not been there, Gene would have been killed right there.
And he got lucky because he found, where they took him, mm-hmm. there happened to be two people who had also been captured, but happened to be really good doctors.
Yes, these were two men from the former Yugoslavia. They were both Serbs, mm-hmm. and they were doctors. And when Gene went to this, it was Sandbosel, a prisoner of war camp, and it had every nationality you can think of. And again, I've been here. This is actually a museum now. They saved part of it. And when I talked to the expert and the archivist there, these doctors were given a chance to go home once Yugoslavia had been conquered, and they said, no, we will stay. And these doctors were performing 40 surgeries a day, and they saved Gene's life. And they actually took a flesh plate and sewed it into his head. And later, some of the French prisoners would tease him and say, oh, you like vodka now, you like vodka now. And he didn't understand what that was, but they just explained there are so many dead Russian prisoners here. They were treated differently than the other Allied prisoners.
Yeah.
They were not signatories to the Geneva Convention. And of course, the war on the Eastern Front was so brutal, the hatred was so palpable there. They're all like, I'm sure that your flesh plate in your head came from a dead Russian. So Gene didn't know for sure, but that was the story.
And so he obviously he's in terrible pain, but he also received fairly good treatment. The French were giving him some pretty good treatment, but eventually then he got better enough that they moved him off to the first of a couple of different, two or three different concentration camps.
Yeah, his first POW camp, things weren't too bad. First of all, he was treated like a celebrity. He said he remembered German soldiers coming into his barracks and saying, Ist das ihn? You know, is that him? And
that story about his four-mile fall.
Yeah, they wanted to meet the guy that survived the four-mile fall. So and then the French treated him like a celebrity. They had a secret Christmas party they invited him to, and he drank way too much homemade cognac. But he was bedridden for about 2 months. But it was also the French that snuck him out at night for secret walks, and they said, "You've got an ordeal coming up. You need to get strong. You need to start walking." And then the first place he went to was down in Frankfurt, the Dulag Luft. That was the Nazi interrogation center. And he almost got in some trouble there because he got into an argument with an interrogation officer. But then he did go. His first POW camp would be in what is now Lithuania. This was the farthest east of the German POW camps. And on the way there, Gene almost died a few times. Their train was... endured a few bombing runs. There were a few bombing attacks that they had to endure, and Gene thought, I'm going to die again. And I think that's one thing when people read this book, they're going to be like, my God, this guy had more lives than a cat.
Yeah.
And he was in the Stalag Luft 6 that was in Lithuania for about 5 months before the Russian front started coming. And then that was July of 44, they were thinking, hey, we might be liberated. And the Germans were going to keep their prisoners. And then he went on that horrific hell ship ride to his next POW camp.
Yeah. And I should, and you were coming back and forth a little bit in the narrative back home, mm-hmm. Because they first, his parents or the family learned that he was missing.
Yes.
And of course, I think it was his mother's favorite.
Yeah. they had six kids, but as one of the sisters said, oh, we all knew he was her favorite. So it was devastating to the mother. I relied on that story heavily from Jean's sister, Joanne, who's still alive, and gave me a lot of information when the MIA telegram came in. It was just before Christmas. And his mother fainted, and she just...
Yeah,
she went into convulsions and weeping fits, and she was despondent. And Jean's older brother actually got married over at the end of December at Christmas. And Joanne said it was more like a funeral. Everyone was coming up to the family and condoling the mom. It was just an extremely difficult time. But
eventually, though, they learned that he's... alive.
They did, through the strangest of sources. They started getting these anonymous letters from about, I think Joanne said about 5-6 of them. And they said, hey, they were ham radio operators that could speak German. They were picking up broadcast of an American flyer that fell 4 miles and lived. And then one letter said, well, it was a guy from Wisconsin. And then one person actually said the name. And then they said from Gays Mills, Wisconsin. That was the nearest post office. So they get about 4 or 5 of these, and it's like, do we dare believe? Is this correct? Do we know? And then finally, Gene did get was able to send a postcard letting his parents know he was alive. So it was true.
Well, the time that he spent in those camps was horrific too. But I think, you know, in those camps, really terrible conditions. And then having to get up and march to get away from, I mean, I guess the Germans didn't want to leave them for the Russians.
So his second POW camp was in eastern Germany, which is now part of Poland, Stalag Luft 4. And this was a much rougher place than he was at. The construction wasn't finished, and they're just running out of food. I mean, their soldiers don't have enough to eat, so certainly POWs are not going to be a priority. But it was first week of February 45 when, again, the Russians are coming, and the prisoners hear the guns, and they're thinking perhaps we'll be liberated, but no, the Germans are going to keep them and march them west. And... in the research that I did, it was always the question, why not just let them go? And the prisoners themselves are like, what's the point? Why keep us? It seemed to be that Hitler and maybe some higher members of the German military were thinking about using them as bargaining chips at the end of the war in some type of negotiated settlement. And I know with how the war ended, that seems like fantasy. But at the time, they thought, well, let's hang on to these guys and see if they can be some type of bargaining chip for us at the end of the war. And then, yeah, what started was 80 days and 600 miles of what is called the European Death March. And these guys, it wasn't like the Bataan Death March with, you know, intentional cruelty from the soldiers, but it was the cruelty of neglect, of no food, disease. The men suffered terribly from dysentery. They slept in frozen swamps at night. If they were lucky, they found maybe a barn. They scrounged for food. And I think they were dropping like flies. And sometimes Gene said they would just fall into a ditch and die.
And he made it. Finally, they get to the point where they're seeing U.S. soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
They have to climb. They have to go through this kind of stream over a bridge and so forth. And he literally could not make it up all the way up the hill to get there.
I'm writing this, and it's almost like a Hollywood ending. And I'm like, oh, my God, people aren't going to believe this. But Gene survives when so many others are not. And one of the reasons is he has this uncanny ability to find food when there is none. A lot of the prisoners were about 90 to 100 pounds when they were liberated. Gene was in about 120, 125, somewhere around there. But his feet were so sore. He is barefoot by this time. His clothes are ragged. They crossed the Elbe River several times back and forth. By this point, nobody knows where they're going. But they get to the Mulder River, and then there's rumors we are getting close to the American forces. They notice the German soldiers were becoming more affable and joking around. They're suffering, too. They just want the war over. And then from across the river, they could see the olive green of the American uniforms of it was Patton's army. And the excitement, of course, was palpable. But the bridge they had to cross was bombed out, and some people waited, and then there's about 10,000 refugees on this side of the river. It's not just POWs. It's Poles. It's
everybody.
Everybody trying to escape the Russians, and just the most pathetic mass of suffering people that you could imagine. But Gene and a few of the other guys said, "Well, we're going to try crossing,"
and they made it.
They made it. He got to the last part where the bridge was bombed up, and now the scary part is, it's April, so the river's swollen with spring melt. And Gene knows if he slips and falls into the river, he's not going to have the strength to swim. So he barely gets across. But about that last 50 yards where the bridge is bent and going upward, he couldn't make it. He collapsed. And then an American soldier came down and his words
were,
"I got you, buddy." Picks him up, throws him over his shoulder like a feed bag, and takes him to the other side of the river.
And on that note, there is so much in this book that we have not discussed. And there's so many exciting parts to it. John, it has been a pleasure talking with you, and I really hope a lot of people get to read this book. The book, Tailspin, and the author, John Armbruster. Take a look. You're going to want to read it. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.